Welcome to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey Podcast.
I'm Lucia Kelly, expert at applied analysis, and I'm working tonight because I had to keep on stupid Jeff on the stupid place that I inherited from your stupid uncle. Obviously, no offense. God rest his soul.
And I'm Talia Franks, media critic, fanfic enthusiast, and good-hearted weirdo.
And we're here today for a Wibbly Wobbly mini-sode. Hopefully, please God, please. Hopefully it'll actually be mini this time.
Yeah, it might be not so mini. Today we'll be talking about Eve of the Daleks, which aired on January 1st, 2022. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 22. New Year's Day! It was written by Chris Chibnall and directed by Annetta LaFleur.
Reminder that time isn't a straight line. It can twist into any shape, and as such, this is a fully spoiled podcast. We might bring things in from later in the show, the comics, the books, the audio dramas, or even fan theories and articles.
With that out of the way, we need to formulate a plan which guarantees we make it out before the loop closes. So let's get in the TARDIS.
IMDb says this is the episode where Sarah owns and runs Elf Storage, and Nick is a customer who visits his unit every year on New Year's Eve. This year, however, their night turns out to be a little different than planned.
Our synopsis says this is the one where Dan assigns himself conductor of the Thousand Train. Choo-choo!
He really does, doesn't he? God bless. He's like, I've had enough. I watched this woman pine for 4 years. I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah, and notice he said 4 years, which lends credence to the fact that even though they arrived in 1901 and that first timestamp was 1904, by the time that they did all that traveling, it was 1905.
It sure was. You cannot speed up steamers. It's just not, you can't speed up raising the money for steamers. We've covered this already. Anyway, Dan, God bless. I was so ready. I was so ready to be like, finally, at last, you know, he's not going to do anything wrong. He's not going to mess up anything. He's not going to tell any bad jokes. And then he outs Yasmin. And it's like, for what?
You mean when he tells the doctor that she likes her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know where I stand on that. It left a sour taste in my mouth. I appreciate that clearly the vibe was like we're beyond that being an issue or a problem, and like the doctor's take on gender and gender identity and sexuality is so far beyond that, like, but it's also like Yasmin says herself, I hadn't even told myself that, right? Like, this is very, very delicate and new and personal to her. And the fact that Dan was just like, by the way, like, I get he's as frustrated as we are. I sympathize with the man, but also don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. But everything else, also, I think that puts him sacrificing himself as the sort of decoy man in a whole new light as well. Like, he 100% is like, if I'm not there, they'll have a moment.
Yeah, I like Dan just getting himself out of the way, recognizing he's not needed.
What was it? The inferior human?
Yeah, the inferior human. And I love also that everyone was just ragging on Dan so much because he's so unnecessary. But also, Yas does have that moment where she's like, hey, no one's allowed to pick on my mate but me.
The Yasmin-Dan friendship means so much to me. They're tender in a very specific way, which means constantly insulting each other, which just warms my heart.
Yeah, it's a great kind of friendship. I love how this episode is an isolated episode, but still wraps up a lot of what's happening in Flux. And I told you that what went on with the doctor messing up the Daleks and the Cybermen and the Centaurans wasn't over. I told you that the doctor was going to have a reckoning and that there was going to be consequences. And I was right. I was right. I feel so vindicated.
I agreed with you. Why are you yelling at me like this? I agreed with you.
No, because I... No, because I, maybe it's not you, but I feel like there was just so much pushback, maybe not from you, but like from the general ether of people on the internet. There was so much haterade for the doctor's actions. Clearly there's going to be a through line of consequences for the doctor. Like the doctor says, my actions are catching up with me.
And but she then takes back at the end. And I'm like, God damn it.
No, but the thing is, it's not the doctor taking it back per se. It's the doctor retreating back into her shell. She was vulnerable for that moment. And now she's taking back that vulnerability because it's not necessary for her to be vulnerable anymore. She's retreating from her trauma, which is a totally reasonable reaction.
I know, but like, oh, I do like that Yasmin, like the look that Yasmin gave. What I do like about the way that, even though I would personally prefer to have that moment, have it out in the open so that we can have a really clean last bit of Phasmid, basically, like the doctor and Yasmin just being on the same page, being open and cool with each other for the last of the specials. I fully understand why they're doing it this way and that we probably won't get a resolution until the very end, because that's how television works. And it's also, as you say, how reactions to trauma and reactions to learning to be vulnerable in that way works as well. And I did also really like the direction and how Jodie was acting in this, or how Whittaker was acting in this episode. It's very clear just how out of control the doctor feels. And she's acting way out in order to mask that pretty unsuccessfully.
Yeah, and I will say that this makes a lot of sense for the doctor. Like, this is definitely something that the doctor would do. The doctor is not someone who typically is this vulnerable with people. The doctor is someone who's often very closed off and has these moments of vulnerability and then has these moments of going back in on themselves again. Like, this is very typical for the doctor. And so I'm not at all surprised that this is what has happened. And especially in this episode, because there's that moment when the Dalek first exterminates them and the doctor doesn't know that she's going to make it out. And she says, and just that soft moment. And I just love Whittaker's acting here. There's that soft moment where she just says, not like this, because she's come across the Daleks so many times. She's fought them so many times. She's gone through so many battles. And then she's like, am I really going to die like this? Like, is this really going to be it?
Not in elf storage. Yeah, but you know what it is? Do you know what I reckon it is? I'm still going through Eccleston withdrawal. I think that's what it is, because Eccleston as a doctor of the modern doctors was the most vulnerable and would absolutely have those moments far more often with Rose than I think any other doctor has with any other companion. And I'm just like, God damn it, doctor, get yourself together, like have a moment. And that's not where the doctor is on their journey anymore. And it's, I miss Eccleston.
Yeah, I think it very much is the consequence of you not watching these episodes in sequential order. I think you need to watch all these episodes in the correct order. But also, I think it's also a mark of the fact that the doctor is someone who isn't going to be particularly open and isn't going to be all like touchy-feely open with her emotions. And I feel like there is a bias and a want for her to do that. And there's always been a want for the doctor to be more open with their emotions. To a certain extent, that is even more heightened now that we have a woman doctor. And all of us need to acknowledge that bias. Even those of us who feel like we don't have that bias still probably have that underlying bias, even if we say we don't.
It's the most dangerous kind, the bias you don't think you have.
Yeah. I also was thinking about circling back to this idea of wrapping up Flux. This is still very new. And by this, I mean, the companionship between the doctor and Dan is very new, because he says, "You saved the world last week," which means there's only been a week of Dan being a companion on the TARDIS. And Dan was barely a companion before. He was a companion for like a few hours before he and Yaz got yanked back to the early 1900s. So the whole reason he's on the TARDIS is because he and Yaz have that bond. I maintain the only reason he's a companion is because Yaz is like, "That's my friend, we're bringing him." And so the doctor's still early on in her friendship with Dan. So the fact that she has that, "I don't know what you're talking about," when he's trying to have a heart to heart with her, makes total sense. Because like, why is she going to open up to this dude she's known for a week? You know? And I think also probably what they've been doing in that week is cleaning up after the Flux. Because just to also make a quick note, because I know that this is something that I've seen some discourse about, and I don't really remember if we talked about it specifically, but my personal theory of how they reset the universe is because every Christmas, New Year's time, BBC America does a full marathon of all of Doctor Who for like days and days, 24 hours long Doctor Who marathon. And I didn't watch the whole marathon, but when I turned it on, they were replaying Flux. Right when I turned it on, it was during Azur's little religion speech. And she said that they were going to undo and redo the Flux as their sort of game. And I'm like, oh, that means the Flux is undoable. It's possible to reset the universe. And so my theory is that the doctor just went and did what they were going to do and reset the Flux. Because it seems entirely possible for me, if the Ravagers were going to do it, the doctor can figure it out. The doctor can figure out how to undo the Flux and reset the universe, given enough time. Like, she didn't have enough time when she killed all those Daleks and Cybermen and Centaurans. But clearly the Daleks are back. So she didn't actually kill all of them. She killed a lot of them. She killed a giant fleet of them. But when she reset the universe, she obviously reset the Daleks and Cybermen and the Centaurans too. So that genocide that she committed was not actually. She brought them all back. She brought everyone back.
I mean, then it wouldn't make sense. I mean, it would, because the Daleks want the Doctor dead anyway. But like, if she brought them all back, then... But yeah, resetting the universe is an interesting tidbit. Because I'm sorry, does Sarah and Nick not know what a Dalek is at this point? That made no sense to me. We've had Journey's End. We've had so many. We've had Doomsday. We've had so many moments. How do they not know what this thing is?
You're forgetting about the crack in time and space. You're forgetting about the crack in time and space, which ate up everyone's memories of the Daleks and explicitly rewrote the fact that no one remembers the Daleks, which is the whole point of victory of the Daleks, is that no one remembers them. Specifically, Amy didn't remember them. I think this is a good segue to talk about Sarah and Nick, which we definitely should do. So I think one thing we definitely should talk about is Nick's storage unit.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about this.
Let's talk about Nick's storage unit, because it's creepy. It's a lot. It's a lot. And I've been seeing some mixed reactions to it online. And honestly, I think this is a case of sloppy writing, because for me, when I saw it, I was like, oh, here is someone who's super neurodivergent, has hoarding tendencies, can't get rid of stuff, has a lot of failed relationships, is probably feeling upset about those failed relationships, can't bear to get rid of his ex's stuff, but also can't bear to look at it. Like, for me, when I broke up with my ex, I'm like, I don't want to look at that, but also I feel weird getting rid of it. Also, because like I'm autistic and I definitely have a thing where I don't like to get rid of things. I have a lot of sentimental attachment to physical objects. And so I really identified with Nick not wanting to get rid of stuff. And when Sarah said, just throw stuff away, that was really triggering for me. And I was very upset. I super identified with Nick. And also I super identified with when he finally had that moment where he's like, okay, I'm over this. I don't need this stuff anymore. I don't need to be reminded of my exes. I can just let the doll explode all up. I'm fine with it all being gone. That for me was the moment where I was like, okay, I can throw away all my ex's stuff. I don't need it anymore. Like, I super identified with that. So then when I went online and I saw all these people who were like, Nick's a creepy stalker. This is raising a huge red flag. Like, he's reminding me of these terrible guys I've dated. I was like, huh, that's a completely different lens that I did not see at all.
Yeah. Okay, so first of all, Sarah and Nick should not get together at the end of this episode, but for entirely different reasons. Like, it's not Nick. I entirely agree. Like, the neurodivergency that is just beaming out of this man, right? Like a big signal. But like, I adore Sarah, but I don't think she's a good person. Like, or I think that she's a person with a very negative bias, which makes sense. Like, the way that they wrote Sarah makes me so happy, because so rarely, and this is a props to the writing and the actor as well, so rarely is a woman given the role to be just that much of an asshole. And like, also in a way that is sympathetic. You totally understand exactly how she's gotten to this point of just fuck everyone. I hate the world. This is terrible. That very particular negative and sort of outsized negative bias is very rarely given such, is allowed to be felt in its full force while still being recognizable as human and forgivable. And I feel like that same grace was not given to Nick in a very significant way, which is really unfortunate. But also, like, they had not sorted out any of their issues, like any of them really, in the evening that they spent together. And now they're like, I'm going to travel the world with you. Everything's going to work out fine. And I'm like, no.
No, no. No. Absolutely not. Especially when they said this is their first date, is them
right together. Like, take it a coffee first, mate. Take it a see if you can hold a conversation with each other without being threatened by Daleks. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Be friend, like, figure out if you can be friends. Like,
yeah. And also, like, yeah, and then there's also, like, the fact of, because also the other people, the other thing that people were saying was stalkerish was that he always, like, made a point to come on a specific day that he knew that she would be working, which, for me, like, I waffle back and forth on this, because it's like on the one hand, that's kind of weird. But on the other hand, like, it's not like he was harassing her at work. She didn't even know that he liked her. Like, it was just someone who came in to, like, visit his storage unit frequently. Like, it's just a customer who comes in frequently and, like, has, like, friendly greetings. Like, she had no idea that he liked her. She had no idea, which, like, for Nick speaks of pining more than stalking. It's not like he knew where she lived. It's not like he knew her phone number. He didn't know any, it's not like he seems to know any significant details about her life. He just happens to know where she works. Like, there are plenty of people who, like, run into someone or meet someone because they happen to know where they work.
Or even, I'm thinking of, like, I like to go to certain coffee places on certain days because I know, like, I know a certain barista will be there. And, like, I like the way they make their coffee. Like, once you start building a relationship with someone, once you start knowing someone, like,
yeah,
like that. And Nick even makes that point in that moment when they're having that discussion and she's like, stalker much? And he's like, well, no. And, like, you know what, yeah, he had points.
Yeah, it's like, for me, it's like, I don't, like you said, it really gave me the same vibes of, like, when I was in college and I went to the same Dunkin' Donuts so consistently that anytime I walked up, they made my order for me before I actually was there. Like, literally, when I went to this Dunkin' Donuts on my college campus, like, anytime I walked up, they would already have my order ready for me, to the point where one time I decided to order something different just for variety. And they were like, that's weird. Here, like, here's your order. You don't have to pay for it. I already made it. Like, I was like, okay.
Yeah, no. Nick is fine. Sarah is fine. But they will not be fine together. I will tell you that. No.
I said it in my live tweet. I did not buy into their chemistry. I feel like they trauma bonded.
Oh yeah. It was giving me such massive, massive Speed vibes. Like, you know, the old Keanu movie?
I think I saw it once, like, very, very many years ago. It has Keanu and Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. And they literally have a conversation about how, like, we're trauma bonding right now. This isn't a good idea. And then it's like, 90s music, swell. It's a good idea anyway. Don't worry about it. Credits roll.
Like... yeah. It makes me think of how in all of those, like, movies where, like, the couple gets together and then in the sequel, the couple is broken up. It's not, and, like, people sometimes make light of those movies and be like, oh, it's so trite how in the sequel, the couple is just breaking up and getting back together again. And that's so ridiculous that the plot of the sequel also has romance troubles. And it's like, no, it makes sense because the only reason they got together in the first movie was because of trauma. The second movie is them actually figuring out if they actually work. Like, it makes sense that they're broken up in the second movie because the only reason they got together in the first movie was because of trauma. The second movie is for them to figure out if they actually work as a couple.
Also, like, I'm sorry, but, like, sorry to talk about your country in this way, but specifically American rom-coms are, like, I can't watch them. They give me so much anxiety. They never love each other. They just shout and yell and do banter back and forth and tease and be mean to each other. And then they're like, we love each other, actually. Mwah. I'm like,
do not feel offended. I think that I will feel offended about you hating on American rom-coms, because I also hate American rom-coms. They suck.
This is not the model for love.
I do like certain romance novels, but most of the romance novels I like are ones where the forces keeping the couple apart aren't their love for each other, but like outside forces. It's like, I love the romance novels where they get together early in the book, and the reason that there's conflict in the rest of the book is because of like outside issues. Like, I really like you never doubt in the book the couple's affection for each other. Like, you never doubt that the couple are a good match. What you doubt is their ability to surmount obstacles against them. So that's like what I like in different romance novels, is when there's outside conflict that's messing with the inner conflict of the couple. But this is no longer a minisode.
So now that we've had that tangent, as is our want, is there anything else we really want to cover?
So the thing that I just want to give another space for is the fact that this show, again, feels weird to say this, but it's centering the death of a Black character. Because the thing is, and this is interesting to articulate, because obviously everyone in the show keeps dying. Like, it's a time loop. And the time loop restarts when everyone dies. But the reason that I say that it's centering the death of a Black character is because Nick's dying is in multiple scenes, like the central effect, because he's the first person who dies. And so his death is, so the first time he dies, it's like the instigating event. It's the first thing that you see is a Black man dying, which is triggering. And then there's the time where he stops the Daleks from killing him, and no one believes that he's able to do it himself. Well, not no one, but like, he's able to do it himself, and then he's like very clever about it, and the doctor's like, oh, nice job. But Sarah's like, no, you didn't. Like, first of all, that's a dick move. Then when everyone gets killed right away, you see Sarah die first, but her death is like much more drawn out. Like, all the others' deaths are much more drawn out, but Nick just like gets killed like right away. And then there's the time where he sacrifices himself, because he basically, like I said, Nick just like you said, like he just exudes like so much neurodivergency, and he gets so overwhelmed and he just can't handle all of it. And so he goes and sacrifices himself. He's like, take me instead. And so then he ends up being cut out of a lot of the discussion. He ends up getting cut out of a lot of the plan and cut out of a lot of the action. And so his screen time is even just reduced there. So he becomes, in multiple cases, a kind of martyr. Even again, when we have that whole discussion about what they're going to do, there's a deprioritization of Nick. Sarah wants to go save him. The doctor's like, no, stay here. And it's like, Nick could be dying. Like, why is the doctor, like, it seems so unlike the doctor to not want to save someone. And the doctor like reluctantly goes to save Nick. And the only reason he's saved is because he ends up saving himself. So it's like, one, that seems really out of character for the doctor. But two, it just like, it leaves a really icky feeling for me. And it's a lot of it is because it's a repeated pattern. And it's a repeated pattern. And it's the fact that there are so few Black people and people of color on the show. When you have a large amount of representation, when you have consistent representation, that's when you can begin to put people of color and people from marginalized groups into these categories of victims and of villains and of constantly being put in these positions where they are further being marginalized within the show. When all of these people who are like surviving and thriving in the show come from privileged groups, and you have so few people who come from marginalized groups in the show at all, that's when it becomes a problem that all of these people from marginalized groups are constantly being further marginalized within the show. When there's a fuller schema of representation in the show as a whole, that's when you can fully put everyone in all of the roles.
And I know we've discussed before, this is a problem throughout the show, but also specifically with Chris Chibnall, the continual and specific sacrificing of Black people in a way that is like, it also struck me this episode just how much Nick's deaths are more violent and are more, there's more emphasis put on them than anyone else in the show. Like we are very deliberately using this Black man who is very clearly neurodivergent as the core center of the violence. And that is a problem that has been like part of the show from inception, but specifically, I think it's been specifically brought to light under Chris Chibnall's stewardship of the show.
I don't know that that's entirely fair to say. I think there was a lot of issues with this under RTD as well. I think Chris Chibnall definitely has a problem with colorblind casting, which is the effect of writing characters like without race, which is basically writing every character as a white character and then putting people of color into those roles, without then accounting for a shift in how they will be perceived. But that was also a problem in RTD's run. That was a very big problem in RTD's run. Think, for instance, of Midnight, where there's the stewardess who sacrifices herself for everyone, and you never even know her name. That's a Black woman. That's a Black woman who dies. It's a Black woman in a service position who sacrifices herself for everyone on that ship. And attention is drawn to the fact that you never even know what her name was. And that hits a lot different when it's a Black woman than when it would be any other person of any other. Because if you think about the specific position that Black women hold in society, think about the fact that the only other person of color in that episode who was also a Black woman was also consistently marginalized, had her accomplishments taken down, wasn't listened to, was Dee Dee, I think her name was in that episode. And she was also constantly shut down. Her opinions were cut out by the professor. The thing is, I've only seen Midnight, I think once, maybe twice, because I hate that episode so much. And you can tell how much I remember it because those things stick in my brain because I dislike them so much. And so that is something that was definitely a through line in RTD's run as well. Stephen Moffat didn't do a great job with race either. Just look at Danny Pink's treatment. Honestly, I could write an entire thesis on Danny Pink and his treatment and why it's so racist. We'll get there. And what he did to Bill, like, is, I'm still caught up in my feels about that. But the fact is that Moffat just cast slews and slews of white people. Anyway, the point is that none of these showrunners have ever done well with regard to race, I think particular attention is being drawn to Chibnall because he has made so much of an effort to include people of color in every one of his episodes, that it's more obvious when they are mistreated, because he has made an effort, but even when he has made this effort, they are not always included the way that we want them to be. And I think that's part of the double-edged sword, is because there are many of us who want there to be better representation. And so we are advocating for better representation, while at the same time, there are people who think that there is too much representation and that this era is too woke. And so there's been a lot of pushback in that regard. And so really people are just coming at Chibnall from all sides in a way that is just makes it hard. Like, in a way, I feel kind of bad for Chibnall, because it makes it so that everything that he does is looked at with so much more scrutiny than I feel like people look at past eras of Doctor Who, like RTD and Moffat. And I'm really interested to see how people are going to look at Chibnall's era once he's gone. And I think that once we have Chibnall's era as a whole, it'll be looked at with much more grace, because I feel like we give RTD and Moffat a lot of grace that we don't give Chibnall.
I don't give Moffat any grace. I can guarantee that. But
I'm not saying we, I'm saying like the fandom as a collective gives RTD and Moffat a lot more grace than anyone ever gives Chibnall. Not everyone. I know a lot of people who give Chibnall grace, but I think like as the collective fandom, I feel like often gives Chibnall a lot less grace than they give RTD and Moffat. Not maybe not Moffat, but certainly RTD gets a lot more grace.
Yes, I will be fascinated to see once RTD, unless it comes back into power, but that feels too grand. When RTD becomes showrunner again, I'll be very interested to see sort of just how fast the rose-colored glasses come off. Like, once we actually have him making new content, whether that sort of nostalgic, sort of almost reactive defense of RTD, how long that will stay around. And obviously there are going to be people on both ends of the spectrum who are never going to change their opinion and are going to be either diehard fans or diehard haters of any kind of showrunner. But I'll be very interested to see how generally in the community, once we start getting this new content, how RTD will be perceived.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to think about how when RTD was showrunner, the internet wasn't as big of a place. Just thinking about, like, RTD stopped being showrunner in, like, what, 2009? 2009 was, like, the last of the David Tennant specials, and so Stephen Moffat took over in 2010. And people were having very different conversations when RTD was showrunner. And so I think as we go forward, we'll see a very different, but people see the show in a very different light. But this episode is not about RTD. It's about Eve of the Daleks. And it is definitely no longer a minisode.
So, Talia, after this long and varied discussion, where do you come down on Eve of the Daleks? Is it funky, fabulous, or foul?
Fabulous. Definitely fabulous.
Fabulous. Like, I really enjoyed it, despite everything that we've said.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I thought it was really great. I mean, there is a few things I had issue with, but Otherwise, I thought it was a pretty solid episode. I thought they utilized the time loop pretty well. There were a few small things that didn't really make sense, but I don't think they're worth talking about. We can dive into them when we get to this episode in like 5 years.
Yay! Yes, I'd come down fabulous as well. Like, the time loop was really well done. It was a really great way to keep tension throughout the episode. It wasn't too repetitive, despite all of that. The characters were all really well done and fleshed out. Both Sarah and Nick were fully realized three-dimensional people in a way that was great.
Mm-hmm.
We've already talked about our problems with Nick. We don't need to go into them again. And yeah, Dan is firmly on the Thousman train, and it looks like we're talking. The subtext is rapidly becoming text. I'm so happy.
The subtext appears to be text. Now I'm here for it. I'm just waiting for all the fanfic, anticipating. I'm probably gonna write some of it when I gear up to have the wherewithal. Things have been things lately, so my writing has kind of come to a standstill, but eventually it'll happen.
But fortunately, you, dear listener, will not have to wait until the next special to hear our lovely voices, because guess what?
We're in season 2 right now!
Woo! Where we will have full episodes where we can go really deep into discussions. We next episode, I think, is going to be
New Earth.
Yes.
And you can hear us talk about Cassandra
at length. We have such a good conversation about her. So yeah. Look forward to that, and we will see you next time.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this adventure with us through space and time.
You can find us elsewhere on the internet, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram, at WibblyPod. Follow us for more Wibbly Wobbly content.
You can find out more information about us and our content on wibblywobblytimeywimey.net and full transcripts for episodes at wibblywobblytimeywimey.net/transcripts.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can also send us an email at wibblywobblytimeywimeypod@gmail.com.
Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and other platforms, as it helps other people find us and our content.
If you'd like to support us, you can send us a donation at paypal.me/wibblypod.
Special thanks to our editor, Dee, who has been a vital member of the Wibbly Wobbly team.
That's all for now. Catch you in the time vortex.